No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
Hello, welcome to A Public Affair. Happy New Year. I'm Esti Dinor, and I have a lot of hope, actually, for 2013. I think it's the beginning of a new cycle, and things will get better, though it will take time and struggle and pain, without a question. To start the year, I have today Cynthia Kaufman. She is the author of the brand new book, Getting Past Capitalism, History, Vision, Hope. She's the director of the Institute of Community and Civic Engagement at the De Anza College, where she also teaches philosophy. And hello, Cynthia. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What do you think? Are we heading towards better or worse?
You know, I think it's all about, as you said, the struggle and what we do about it. My feeling is that we're at a time in the world where things can't go on as they've gone on. If you think about the climate crisis especially, that says the world's got to change a lot soon, and hopefully we're up to the challenge.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about getting past capitalism, and one wonders whether that is possible. Here is that huge, many-headed monster that has ruled the world for quite a while and seems to keep taking more captives. For example, look at China. It's supposedly communism, but it really is state capitalism. Is it possible to get past capitalism at this time in human development?
I think it is, and I guess what I think is that that's our only hope for the future. And you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is that a lot of times when people are critical of capitalism, they tend to have this view that we live in a capitalist society, which means everything about it is capitalist, and so we need to just overthrow it, you know, kind of in one grand movement, or we're stuck with it. And the point of my book is to say that there are lots of things that we can do and that we're already doing to get rid of capitalism, and there are also lots of non-capitalist things and aspects of our lives that are the things that sustain us that we already have. So it's not a matter of, oh, is there some alternative, like, you know, some fantasy of socialism. But there are all kinds of things that we do already, like cooperatives, like taking care of ourselves, taking care of our friends and each other, that are non-capitalist, that we just need to build on and grow.
So explain how taking care of ourselves and each other is not only non-capitalist, but maybe anti-capitalist. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a really good distinction that you made, because what I think is that there are lots of non-capitalist things, and one really important piece of this is for us to take seriously and honor all those non-capitalist things in our lives. So you imagine if we were all to be able to work, let's say, 20 hours a week, we wouldn't need to consume nearly as much as we consume. So we could spend more time cooking for ourselves, taking care of our friends' children, and you know, making things ourselves. So there's ways that the less we have capitalism in our lives, the more we're able to do all these, you know, take care of ourselves in ways that are more environmentally sustainable and more personally and humanly satisfying. So that's the non-capitalism piece. The anti-capitalism piece is another thing, which is we do have to fight. So you know, one of the reasons in this country that it's hard for people to work short hours is because we don't have national health insurance. So if we all push to have it be that there is national health care, then we're not dependent on our job for our health care, and then we're much more free to be able to work less.
Mm-hmm. Well, most countries in the world do actually have nationalized health care, including capitalist countries, Western Europe. Well, I don't think Scandinavia is capitalistic especially, but England, for example.
Right. So, no, you're on a really good thread there. And what I would say is that it's helpful to not see countries as capitalist or non-capitalist, but to see it as kind of a continuum. And like you were saying, the Scandinavian countries are much less capitalist than countries like England, which is not quite as capitalist as the United States, and the United States isn't quite as capitalist as we think of it either. So what I would say is that the forces of capitalism have a lot of control in this country, and they're why we don't have national health insurance, and it was strong socialist and anti-capitalist movements that made it so those other countries have national health care. So I like to think of those kinds of things where we're taking care of each other and attending to people's needs as kind of tactical moves in an anti-capitalist struggle.
Mm-hmm. So explain how the United States is not as capitalist as we tend to think.
So in my book, I really rely on the work of these two thinkers, Kathy Gibson and Julie Graham, and what they argue is that more than half of the U.S. economy is not capitalist. So if you think about economic activity, let me step back for a second. So many of the things that you know women have traditionally done don't count. If you have a capitalist paradigm, when you think of the economy, you think of just the things that make it to the market. But lots of things we do to take care of ourselves never make it to the market. So things like cooking dinner for our friends is not considered productive, but cooking dinner in a restaurant is considered productive. So if you take all the productive activity that people do that doesn't make it into the market, those things are non-capitalist economic activity, so kind of self-provisioning, mutual care, that kind of stuff. We also have cooperatives in this country. We have worker-owned cooperatives, Wisconsin is a place that has actually a good history of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also, what I would say is that it's helpful to think of situations, so think of public schools. I teach in a community college, so I think of that as in some ways technically a socialist activity. What we do is we tax everybody in the society, and then we have a political process that decides where the resources should go, and we decide that we should educate our population. And so I think of public schools as a socialist, as having a socialist element to them.
Mm-hmm. And that is, isn't it, why the Republicans are so busy defunding?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so there's a way that, when the Republicans now call anything that's sort of, a public good, they call that socialist. And that's why Obama is a socialist, because there's some public goods that he supports.
Yeah.
And I think what most people do with that is to say, oh, no, it's not socialist. This is just normal American activity. And I think it depends on who you're talking to and when you're talking to them. But I would say for our own understanding of the world, it makes sense to call those things socialist and to mm-hmm. grant that point to the Republicans.
So you mentioned Obama. I want to talk for a minute about the agreement that was just struck, the preliminary agreement anyway, about the so-called fiscal cliff. At first, if you just listen to the news, it seemed like Obama has succeeded in actually taxing the very rich. But then soon enough, we found out that actually we will be paying more taxes than they will, of course, and that it really isn't a very good deal, especially when you look at all the services that will be cut. And, I was wondering if maybe this was the best possible deal that could have been struck if you are wedded to capitalism. But if Obama really were a socialist or semi-socialist or something other than a capitalist, could there have been something else that could have passed? Could he have forced the Republicans into other things?
I think I would pose that a little bit differently. People often make the comparison between Obama and Franklin Roosevelt. And one of the things I would say is that by temperament, they're very similar. They're very mainstream kind of men of the machine. But what was different during the Great Depression was there was a strong social movement that pushed Roosevelt and pushed the country so that there was a sense of crisis. And Roosevelt had to make all kinds of concessions to the working class. And I would say similarly right now, it's not so much if Obama were a socialist, because actually I think he did probably the best that he could have given what I would say the sort of conjuncture of forces that we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, even if he were a stronger and more progressive man, I don't think he could have done better, because we don't have enough of a strong social movement pushing the political system. And so that's what I would say, is I wouldn't blame him as an individual or his politics. I think it's about us, actually, and our strength.
Interesting message that we heard 2 weeks ago for my guest then, who was talking really in spiritual terms about our state. But it struck me as I was reading your book that really in many ways what you say and what she says are very similar. And you actually do touch on the spiritual. It seems like you are quite well-versed in Taoism. Explain what you're talking about, if you will, in those terms, and explain also the importance, if you see such a thing, of spiritual work within this kind of anti-capitalist work.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I haven't been asked that before at all.
All right.
You know, what I would say is that there's a way that I do think that capitalism destroys our spirit, in the sense that it takes, that it's like a parasite that turns all kinds of complicated life processes into profit, right? It makes it so that the point of everything is to gain a profit out of it. And that's really soul-killing. And, you know, you think about how human relationships get more and more kind of colonized by capitalist processes, and, you know, people judging each other by the products that they have and things like that, and all those kind of status issues. There's a really interesting literature developing on happiness that I think is very powerful, where, you know, social scientists are studying what makes people happy, and no surprise, it's things like a strong spiritual life, connection with other people, strong human relationships, strong sense of community that make people happy. And that money doesn't make people happy, you know, as long as you have enough to kind of survive. Anyhow, so that's kind of one angle on that, is that I do think that we have a strong life of the spirit when we have a strong sense of community, and we need to get past capitalism to have that. Then the other piece that you raised, the point about Taoism in the book, is that one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is that anti-capitalists have tended to, I think, have kind of a militant black and white view of the world, which is sort of there is this evil thing and we're going to kill it, and don't then sort of reflect internally on what are the ways that we ourselves get kind of brought into all of that and become a part of the machine ourselves. And so that there's a piece in Taoism that's about not kind of externalizing the other, and it's also about not, you know, people often know about sort of jujitsu moves in Aikido, where the idea is you don't just, you know, sort of punch your opponent, but you try to use your opponent's energy to transform your opponent. And I think that's a piece that I want to kind of hold on for anti-capitalist strategy, for us to really think about how we can create strong networks of relationships that make it so that we build a better world. And that doesn't mean that there isn't a fight in there, but it also means that it's a fight where we're not just saying there is this evil out there that must be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So give an example of Aikido sort of move in the fight against capitalism.
So one of them is that piece that I just said of sort of not... the kind of older anti-capitalist paradigms have, you know, tended to say that it's the ruling class that's the problem. And what I would, you know, and that you need to sort of fight to destroy the ruling class. And I think that there's some truth in that, and that there really is a small group of people, you know, the 1% is actually really the 0.01% who are controlling the world. And I do actually think that you need to sort of take those people's power away. I really do. But there's a bunch of other things that have to happen. It's about sort of decolonizing our own consciousness, and so it's about again, not sort of saying we have to take them down, but it's about looking internally and changing who we are. Yeah, maybe that's not so much an Aikido move. Maybe that's not a good example.
Let me just interject while you think about it. It reminds me of these Japanese movies, old Chinese movies rather, where the hero comes to fight the really evil person, but on the way to get into him, he has to fight armies and gangs and so many. So we're still definitely in the in that stage of fighting all the armies of those 0.1%. So how do we do that Aikido style?
Uh, Yeah, and so I think, again, it's about changing our consciousness. It's about changing our relationships. It's about, yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay. So, Cynthia, beyond that, or besides that spiritual part, you also talk about anti-capitalists learning from feminists. You actually mentioned already geographer Julie Gordon, who you quote her as saying anti-capitalists should learn from feminists how to push back on practices they are opposed to. What did or are still feminists doing that anti-capitalists of any gender can learn from?
Right. So the main insight from her that was really what got me started in working on this book and got me out of my sense of pessimism about dealing with capitalism was that, you know, if you think about you just, you know, take just any sort of random kind of feminist perspective where you say, oh, you know, there's this problem of sexism in society and we need to deal with it. You don't say, well, but sexism is a system and the system needs to be overthrown and anything you do to kind of make things better is just reformist and it's just kind of helping sexism. You don't say that. What you say is, oh yeah, there's all these different things, you know, from household, you know, the inequality in people's household labor to the kind of sexualization of you know, women as objects to unequal pay for unequal work. You know, we could, you know, you and I could come up with a list of probably, you know, 50 things that we think of as really important things that need to change to make the world better for women. And some of them are interpersonal, some of them are cultural, some of them are structural, some of them are big structures, some of them are small structures. And what we do as feminists is we take each of those problems and we dig in and we start to work on them. And so that for me is the core insight about what I'm saying in the book, is that we have to take that kind of approach when we talk about anti-capitalism. So it's about, you know, struggling at the transnational level to, you know, the work that was done to make sure that the WTO wasn't able to, you know, find a new deal to, you know, struggle against the International Monetary Fund. But then, you know, again, other macro things, like we should be working to have a tax on financial transactions. But we also should be building co-ops and developing forms of community capital. We should be decolonizing our minds so that we don't think of ourselves and others as consumers. So that's the point, is that we have a whole range of activities that we need to take at really different levels, and they don't necessarily all add up.
Yeah. I want to get back to that. We do have a caller for you, though. My guest is Cynthia Kaufman. She is the author of Getting Past Capitalism, History, Vision, Hope, and that's what we're talking about. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Today I'm really enjoying your conversation, and it stimulated me to be asking this question. You suggested that the president is doing the best, given his limitations, as is possible, particularly lacking a definitive social movement or a social political movement to urge him to be more realistic in his reforms, more meaningful in his reforms, I think was your intent. So my question is, what would such an organization look like? Would it be more political than social? You know, would it be more economic than political? Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thanks. Great question. I want to start by saying, just to clarify, I didn't say that he was doing his best given the situation. I think, like, Roosevelt wasn't that great either. The point is that I think Obama is a man of the machine in many ways. So it's, but all I'm saying is that, yeah, anyhow, but he did his best on that particular bill. But anyway, I think that the movement needs to be lots of things. I think that the Occupy movement did a huge piece of work for us. In terms of making it now socially acceptable to talk about class inequality. And so that was one really powerful movement that was, you know, not necessarily political, not necessarily economic. It was actually really ideological. And then so much of the follow-up work that's happening now with people doing, you know, actions at sites where people are doing foreclosures and things like that. So what I would say is that to get what we need to get past capitalism, we need all kinds of different struggles. And I actually think that lots of them are happening now, and I want to really value those movements that are happening and for us to really understand how they can add up to getting past capitalism and for us to take pride in them and to celebrate our successes.
And this actually is one main point of your book, isn't it, that the movement is made up of many smaller, more specific movements, and what we need to do is have more of these organizations, more of these movements, and invest in ways, both financial and others, in them. Is that more or less correct?
That's exactly right. One of the ways I like to think about it is that social change, I think of any kind, that it's kind of helpful to break it up into three pieces. There's sort of building the world that you want, you know, the sort of building positive alternatives, like I was saying, kind of cooperatives and things like that, you know, and more support for public goods. And then there's taking down the negative. So that's, you know, laws to keep capital from you know, pillaging society. And then there's the third piece, which is kind of more ideological, cultural, kind of how we understand the world. And I think we need to do all three of those.
Mm-hmm. So here we are doing a lot of this work, and much of it is disparate and kind of dispersed. And in the meantime, the Tea Party has really built an impressive machine that has changed the politics, presumably from the ground up, while we were doing our stuff. Explain why it is that the extreme right has been able to create a movement that has changed political life in the United States, while the left hasn't been all that successful in recent years.
Yeah, I would put that a little bit into a historical context, that I think that our side made some huge gains in, you know, kind of starting with the civil rights movement and kind of moving through the movements of the 60s, and that it's taken a long time for society to digest those changes. You know, and I think about, to integrate anti-racism and anti-sexism and a kind of a concern for the environment and gay rights and all those things into the culture. And we're in a period of incredible sort of transformation where we're sort of integrating those changes into the culture and then also backlash against that. So one of the things I think that happens with the Tea Party is that they learned their organizing skills from us. They also have a ton of money, I mean, really an insane amount of money that we could never have, and that they've been able to really capitalize on kind of the resentments and fear of the, you know, if you look at the class base of the Tea Party, they're not poor people. They tend to be kind of small business people, mostly white. And that there's a kind of a sense of displacement, more male than female. There's a kind of a displacement of, you know, the people often talk about this, sort of like, you know, the angry white man of this period, that there's a cultural displacement and kind of a sense of fear. And so I feel like the right's been able to really capitalize on that and kind of capture people's sense of kind of cultural anxiety. And we haven't done a very good job speaking to those folks. And, you know, I think that we are making successes in our work also. And hopefully the Tea Party thing is running its course. I'm not sure how much, you know, I think that the current political crisis in Washington is the Republican Party is in a little bit of disarray right now.
Mm-hmm. So before I take our next caller, what can we do? How can we bring a message that is, I believe, a lot more realistic and accurate to these people, to these angry white males and females with some money or a lot of money, but who basically, it seems to me like everyone who buys into that, that's what to call it, it's more than ideology, into that system, really, the extreme right, is almost everybody is working against their own interests. How do we reach out to them and bring them around, help them make better choices, at least the way I see it?
Boy, that, you know, that's a really good question, and I don't feel like I have a great answer for that. My sense, so let's step back for a second and say that I think I'm not sure that that's the most important thing in the world to do, because I do think, you know, if you look at this last election, people of color are becoming a majority in this country.
Right.
Young people aren't as conservative as older people. So there is a way, if you just look at electoral politics, that I think that they're going to have to change their game, because the game they're doing right now, it's been very successful in recent years, but it's not going to last for much longer. But I do think that what you're asking is a really serious and important question, and I think there are places like I've been very interested in Vermont and Bernie Sanders, and you know he's a socialist and he is a senator from Vermont, and he's a wonderful guy with a lot of integrity, and Vermont wasn't always a real super liberal state, but what he did was to really talk to people, and like you're saying, is sort of that people, a lot of people who vote that way, that kind of Tea Party way, they're not voting in their own economic interest. They're voting on the basis of some kind of cultural fears and things like that. So I think that it would be really important for people to do, if people who are doing electoral work on a local level, to just talk to people, to really, really engage with people and have those conversations. And I think that Occupy was helpful for opening up some conversation. I think the climate crisis, as people kind of are starting to come out of their denial about it, is another kind of an opportunity for people to have that conversation. So I wish we had a political party in this country that actually did organizing, you know, a progressive political party that actually went and just did that hard, slow work of helping people to see the world in a different way. And I think that that's a one-by-one organizing kind of a thing that has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, thanks. Great show. Thanks for having it.
Okay.
I wanted to follow up on what you just said about local political work and electoral work. I'm concerned about the culture of militarism in our society and how it supports capitalism. And it comes down to things at the local level, like the police department's budget or the sheriff's budget, and there always seems to be a prioritization of what I would consider militarism, even at the local level and state level. And I wonder how, if you could follow up on what you just said about organizing and local political work, how we can shift that sort of culture of militarism from federal to state to local to you know, help us challenge capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cynthia.
Yeah, I guess I want to say that I really agree with you, and I really agree with the that there's the you know, sort of U.S. empire abroad and how much we spend kind of being the police of the world. But I'm also really concerned with the sort of the militarization of our police and, you know, the sort of prison industrial complex kind of situation. I think that's really, really serious. And I also want to highlight what you said, that I do think that there are some real capitalist dynamics in there. You know, if you look at the sort of the U.S., you know, as an imperial power, that most of that's about protecting the world for multinational corporations. And so that is about protecting the world for capitalism. The kind of the militarization of the police and what's happening with the police, I think is a really terrible situation, and the way I understand that, it's a little bit indirect, the connection to capitalism, because what I would say is happening with that is that the Republicans had a really brilliant and horrible strategy of basically hitting on a white racist fears of, you know, people of color as these kind of, you know, forces for kind of, you know, chaos and crime, and use that as an electoral strategy. And there's real explicit places where Nixon's assistant, you know, Haldeman, actually talks about that as an electoral strategy. And they've been using that really successfully ever since the 70s. And I think it's terrifying. And now there are millions of people in jail and in prison kind of as a result of that. So that when I think about sort of changing that dynamics of locking away people of color because it helps some people's elections. By the way, there's a really good book on this by Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow. It's an incredibly powerful book.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of talks about how that all happened. I think the way to fight against that is to expose it, and also to expose the kind of the economic costs of it. So, you know, in California, we've had a really terrible three strikes law. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the country. And we just passed some legislation to make our three strikes law not quite as draconian as it was. And the movement for that talked a lot about how much it costs to incarcerate all those people. And so I think that the sort of the struggle against the kind of the over-incarceration it's partly about sort of letting people know how much it costs and how unproductive it is, and then also kind of helping people pass the racism that makes it so that people fall for the idea that we need to lock up all the people of color. So that's a long-winded answer. That's my sense of what's going on with those situations. And there are lots of organizations working to fight it, and I would say that local ballot initiatives, you know, sort of statewide ballot initiatives against, you know, these draconian laws is really important, and just exposing it. And I would really encourage people to read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow and to talk to people about what's going on with the criminalization of people of color.
Yeah, I actually have been meaning to have her on the show, and I'm glad you reminded me of her. So to get back to what we discussed before, the caller brought his really important point, I think. We were talking about the Tea Party, etc. It seems to me, and I think it really ties into what you say in this book, that it's really important to change. I'm trying to find the right way to put it, but I'm a reformed, angry activist. I'm now an activist out of love, if you will.
Yeah.
Not that long ago, I was in a forum between about one of the issues that rattled us here locally, and sat through much of it watching activists. I know they were very sincere, but I think there was a lot of theatrics there, and I think there was a lot of unproductive anger, and I think that if politics and activism are done out of love or happiness or whatever, out of hope, out of knowing that things can get better rather than despair that nothing will ever change, that we have a much better chance. What do you think?
Oh, I completely agree with you, and I really like the way you said that. And that is what I was sort of trying to get at earlier. I feel like I didn't say that as well as I needed to, but I really agree with you about that. And one of the ways I think about it is that if you work from a place of love and of hope for a better world and really caring for a better world, then you think strategically and thoughtfully about how to make the best difference in the world. If you're working from a place of just anger, as much as I like the band Rage Against the Machine, I think that title says something that's not good, right? Which is the idea that we're just going to rage against the machine. That comes from a sense of hopelessness and a sense of despair, that you're just going to be the person who stands up and tells the truth and says that this is all wrong. And I feel like so many social justice activists are kind of stuck in that place, and it's often really counterproductive because people can't really hear you. The other thing I think is that sometimes there's a way that on the left people will have their politics be kind of part about sort of an identity construction, like I'm this, you know, militant person who is against all these terrible commercial things, and so I'm going to live my life in a different way, and I'm going to be a good person. And it becomes about being a good person as opposed to about being about changing the world. And I think it's important to keep your eyes on the prize and always think about what is that better world we want to live for, and how do we treat each other in the process of getting there, and what are the ways to from right now where we are to build a better world. And sometimes that means really exposing terrible things and taking power from the people who have power. And sometimes that requires some kind of aggressive forms of action, but usually it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Caller?
Yes. I wonder if you could comment on the way we organize our money and exchange to change the capitalist system, especially the banks and the way we finance wars is largely through the banking system and the monetization and finally the financialization of the banking system. Could you comment, please?
Thank you.
Great question. Yeah, so, you know, when you think about capitalism, it's not always one thing and always the same. And I think we're in a period where finance capital is really dominating over productive capital, and that's why things got so crazy and terrible in 2008. So I really agree with you that the sort of that one really important step that's really on our agenda is reining in the control that the finance sector has over our economy. And, you know, and there are lots of, you know, laws in Washington that people are working on that I think are important for that. So I think that has to happen. So just basically putting a leash on the financial sector. And I also think, so that's one kind of macro level thing, you know, a tax on financial transactions that people talk about a lot, I think would be a really important thing to work towards. So that's one thing to work towards reforms of the U.S. finance system at the federal level. But then on kind of a more local and personal level, I think it's really important that people, to the extent that possible, get away from the banks. So there are lots of credit unions that use their capital for local community to serve local and community needs. So I think it's a really easy step for people to do is just to take as much of your money out of the banks as you possibly can. I know I own a house and I have a mortgage and it's with Bank of America and it just makes me sick, but that's what I ended up doing. And, you know, and if I have a chance to refinance my house and get away from that kind of bank, I would really like to do that. But, you know, my regular bank account, checking account and Visa cards and all that, you know, just to the extent that you can to get that into credit unions, I think those things are really important.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go somewhere else. I want to go into environmental issues and talk, first of all, about the connection between capitalism and global warming and other horrible, really global manifestations of mm-hmm. the damage that we do to our planet. Explain the connection, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that is huge, and that's actually the issue that I'm the most active in my own life right now is climate change politics. And, you know, that there are all – what I would say is that if you have the main driver of your economy is profit and profit at all costs, then that means that the environment isn't taken into consideration. And so one of the things that happens with capitalism is that you say – we're going to let markets do their business. We're going to allow people with capital to do what they can on their own to the extent possible. And that's how the economy works. And so then it's very profitable for people to, they call it, externalize their cost to the environment. So if it's cheaper to do things in a way that cause environmental destruction, then that's what they're going to do. And so then, we've lived ever since the 1980s in this country under this ideology that says that regulation is a terrible thing and it sort of distorts capitalism and all that. So that it's really hard to make the case for the need to regulate. So, you know, and if you saw how Obama, when he first was elected, did try to pass some national legislation on climate change, and the oil companies, which control the Chamber of Commerce really powerfully right now, were able to make it so that no law was passed, and that's just devastating. So what I would say is that, yes, capitalism is generally terrible for the environment because it puts pursuit of profit over everything else.
Mm-hmm. A side question, I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to some of the big capitalists and understand how they think, but whether you have or not, how do you understand the way of thinking that puts more profits for people who already have really more than they can spend in several lifetimes? Why are more profits more important than ensuring that their children and their children's children will have a planet they can live on?
Yeah, that is really amazing, isn't it, when you think
it
about
is.
That? I guess what I would say is that, again, just like I was saying with Obama, is that I tend not to think about things too much in personal terms. So what I would say is that we have a system right now. You know, the way corporations are chartered in most states in this country, the corporation has to, by law, put profit first. If it doesn't, it's not being fair to its shareholders. That's a systemic and a legal situation. There's a whole movement for B charters, which we just passed in California, and I don't know if you have it in Wisconsin, but
no.
Basically says that corporations can charter in a different way where they can put human and environmental considerations as part of their bottom line. But right now, that's the law. And if you think about that, so now it becomes a sort of, you know, self-perpetuating beast that then recruits people into it, is what I would say. And so, you know, if some person who is, you know, if you see the movie The Corporation, I can't remember his name, but there's a guy who was like some big, you know, CEO of some oil company who suddenly had that epiphany where he realized that what he was doing was terrible for his grandchildren, and he quit. And that's great, and he's a really honorable man, and he speaks really well about what happened. There's another guy who was the head of one of the healthcare companies that did the same thing. You know, good, honorable people who realize what they're doing is wrong and they change. But the machine goes on without them, right? They're always able to recruit more people into that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I would say, is that there's always some person who finds it fun, thrilling, exciting, and a kind of a sense of status that they get from being, you know, not just the 10th richest guy in the world, but now I'm the 9th richest guy in the world. And that it's a game that people play.
Yeah, very strange and destructive game.
Very strange and destructive, and yet I think it's important to not focus so much on those individuals as mm-hmm. so much as what are the systems that perpetuate that.
And what can we do about them?
Exactly.
So let's talk about that. Let's take the environment as a case study in what you are promoting here. And say we are living in the most capitalist society on the globe. There's very little consideration from the upper echelons to the environment. What can we do living within this system, living in homes that need to be heated? We want running, clean water. We do drive cars because there's no public transportation to speak of. How do we change the paradigm? How do we change things so that we create a better world? How do we think? What do we do? How do we do that?
Yeah, and so I guess my answer is, like I've been answering all along, which may not be very satisfying, is that we do all of it. So if you think about global warming, you know, one of the things that's important for me in my kind of spiritual survival as the planet is heating up is to be involved in climate change work, because the closer you are to it, the more you realize it's happening. If you're not involved in it, it can seem like nobody's doing anything and the world is just getting worse. But all over the country, if you just take Chicago as an example, you know, it's a city that doesn't have a particularly progressive government, and yet they're doing amazing things in Chicago to, you know, to set up green roofs, to do really good, you know, trash systems, to improve their system of public transportation. I work in the Silicon Valley, where we have terrible systems of public transportation, but at my school, some students pushed for an EcoPass, where the students all tax themselves, they all pay an extra $5, and then they get a bus, and everybody gets a bus pass. Mm-hmm. So now more kids are riding the bus. So now the bus company is trying to do what they call bus rapid transit, which is basically cheap light rail, where the buses go faster than cars. So we're going to have that in a few years. So what I would say is that there are lots of things happening at local levels to improve public transportation, to give credits for people for improving their houses and things like that. And then some of those things are happening at city levels. Some of those things are happening at state levels, and we need to support them all. And then there's a movement happening right now that I'm very excited about. There's an organization called 350.org,
right.
And what they're working on is they, I think very correctly, have said that the main thing keeping us from making more progress in climate in this country is the oil companies, that they're controlling the Chamber of Commerce, which controls the government, the federal government, And there's also funding climate deniers and things like that, which makes then the whole culture not take it as seriously as they need to. So the oil companies are really the key if you look at climate change. So what 350 is doing is that they have a campaign asking colleges to for the students to go to their boards of trustees and demand that they divest from any investments in the fossil fuel industry. And I think it's a great move. And even though, you know, the colleges may not have that much money in the fossil fuel industry, it sends a really powerful message. And the idea is to take the way they say it, which I really like, is to take away the social license of the oil companies to destroy the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bill McKibben actually was here at UW-Madison really not long ago, and very soon after that, the students indeed went to the board of, what do they call them here?
They're trustees, not, probably.
Yeah, it's something else, but we understand.
Yeah.
And asked for exactly that. So,
Yeah. And it's spreading all across the country. We're going to be doing it at my college, too. And so, I think there are lots of things like that. And again, what I would say is that pick a place and dig in.
Yeah, yeah. You talk in your book about what you call the economic dependency trap of capitalism. I would like you to explain what that means, and then to talk about the role of unions. I think you have an interesting take on that.
Yeah, that though in some ways that's the part of the book that I feel like I have the least satisfying answer to, let's say. So one of the problems with capitalism is that, you know, I can say, oh, you know, downshift your life, try to be less of a consumer, try to work as few hours as you can and self-provision and, you know, do things cooperatively with your friends. But the fact is, if you don't have a job that brings in enough money for you to basically get by, you're in serious trouble. And so what the economic dependency trap of capitalism says is that there's this unfortunate situation where the better capitalists, when capitalists are doing well, they hire people, and when they're not doing well, they don't hire people. And so there are all kinds of things we can do around. And so what I argue in the book is that that's just a serious problem that there's not an easy solution to. And the best we can do with that is to try to decrease our dependencies on capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like having national health care so it's not a complete catastrophe in somebody's life when they lose their job, that's a really important, that does a lot for us structurally as a nation to make it so that people are less dependent upon their jobs. Then if you think about other things like other ways to decrease that dependency would be to have it be that there are more kind of public goods. You know, if the parks are all free, then people don't need to pay for going to a park, right? So the more we can kind of support public goods, the less dependent we are on capitalism for the things that we need. You know, if everybody has really fantastic libraries, they don't need to buy books. They can get books from the library. So the idea is the more we have public goods, the less dependent we are on capitalism kind of as individuals.
Mm-hmm. And if I read you correctly, you see unions as a kind of a phenomenon that rises out of capitalism, that in capitalism we need something like unions. I'm asking that because for a long time I was very dissatisfied with unions, and then came our Governor Scott Walker and basically
right.
emasculated them, and things got so much worse. But I still feel like there must be a better way to do that, to protect workers, and I'm still looking for that thinker who will come up with some new ideas, which I haven't. What do you have to say to that?
I don't think I'm that thinker who's going to give you the new idea on that, but let me take a stab at what I think about that. I guess I am very pro-union in the sense that if you think about the bargain between capital and labor, capitalists have a lot more power than labor. And so, as I say in the book, you know, historically then, you know, as capitalism grew, workers found ways to get together and demand more power in that situation in which they, you know, are rather dependent and subservient. So I think unions have played a hugely important role in this country. I think they're why we have a middle class in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that unions, there was a whole kind of history of laws that happened that basically emasculated the unions and made them less powerful and less political. In the early days, a lot of unions were very political. So what I would say is that we need to have and you see, you know, glimmers of this in the union movement where they're really trying to do more organizing. You know, there was a while when unions were kind of for privileged, you know, white male workers to kind of protect their jobs, and that's pretty nasty. And they were very exclusionary at many points in U.S. history. And so there's been a move of, you know, unions supporting people of color, women, and also to be more bold. And so that's I guess what I see is that I see a lot of talk in the union movement of putting more of their money into organizing. And I actually think that Scott Walker did a real favor to the union movement by kind of waking it up and also helping people who hadn't seen the positive side of unions to see why they're important. So I think that unions need to get more political and more radical again.
Mm-hmm. And more really pro-workers, I think.
Yes, that's right, because there's a way that it becomes a sort of cushy inside game between the kind of union leadership and the business, you know, and the owners, and that's when unions become kind of dead.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. I hope you're right. We have only 4 minutes left, and I would like you to go... of course, we don't have enough time for all of it, but through your guidelines for action,
mm-hmm.
things that we haven't discussed yet this hour.
Okay, let me just go to that part of the book where, so in the very end of the book, I end with kind of, you know, 10 things that I think you can kind of take away from this, so I'll just kind of breeze through them quickly. So the first one is the idea that we need to delegitimize capitalism, and that's the idea that we need to actually talk about it, because people, I think, have been afraid that if they talk about capitalism, then they're going to get branded as socialists or as communists, and then they're not going to be listened to anymore. And I think it doesn't always make sense to talk about capitalism, but when we're doing our own thinking, we need to understand the system that we're against. We need to also, you know, do kind of cultural work to help people see what's wrong with capitalism. I think Occupy was huge in that. Number three, we need to live in ways that help us not be capitalist desiring subjects. And what I mean by that is just to really think about your relationship to consumerism. Then I think we also need to think about how we measure the economy, because there's this way that people measure right now. If you measure the economy in terms of GDP, you're measuring how well capitalists are doing, but not how well the rest of us are doing. There's a measure called the Genuine Progress Index that's really powerful, and I wish public radio stations would report the news about how the economy is doing using those other indicators.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth one is huge, which is that we need to challenge the major processes of capitalist reproduction. So what that means is, you know, things like racist immigration laws. We need to work on sustainable agriculture, things like that, and, you know, and things like international transaction tax. So just all those big macro level things that need to happen to take down capitalism. We need to work on those. We also need to talk about non-capitalism and how good it is, and not think of it as some imaginary socialism off in the far distant future, but to really think about the non-capitalist aspects of our lives that sustain us and make us happy right now. We need to support community-controlled capital, so where you have communities actually investing in things that are for the community and that don't need to turn a big profit in order to survive. Then I end by saying that we need to build movements in ways that develop people's capacities, and that we need to be really smart and strategic.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say that your book has a lot more than what we were able to get to this hour. I actually got quite excited about the way you put things together, and I do recommend that people get it. What would you like to discuss in the last minute that we have?
You know what I want to talk about is how people can get my book, because right now the book is only out in hardback and it's very expensive. So if anybody would like a copy of it, to please just email me and I'll send you a PDF.
Uh-huh, wonderful. And also,
and the way to email me, it would just be to Google my name and you'll find me.
And people, of course, can ask their public libraries to buy a
please,
copy.
And please, thank you, and please ask your public libraries and school libraries to get a copy of my book, and it will be out in paper in September. And I guess I just say, the thing I think I want to end with is just to say that I think it's important that we think about the positive world that we live in that has all kinds of great human relationships built on care and compassion and concern for each other and for the environment, and to think about that as what we want to build, and to think about capitalism as a virus that's destroying that and is parasitic on that we need to push back.
Yeah. Thank you so very much, Cynthia Kaufman, the author of Getting Past Capitalism, History, Vision, Hope. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated it.
And thanks to Mark and Lois, I believe, and all the kids. They're going to tell you what station you're listening to in a minute. I'm STD Noor, and I'll be back again next week with, I think, a somewhat darker vision of capitalism and the world that we live in. Thanks for listening and calling in. Bye-bye.